Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. We are in the midst of putting the pieces together for you. As you understand, the Constitution is a compact. The Constitution has very limited and defined roles, responsibilities. Let me just put it into a simpleton like me can get this. And I believe you should probably have a quicker epiphany than I. If you understand a power of attorney can either delegate very specific powers that you want one person to execute for you, or you can give them general powers. The Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of your state is either a general constitution or it is a enumerated constitution. In other words, it's either granting general powers or it is granting enumerated powers. There is nowhere in the United States Constitution that there are any general powers granted. And as a matter of fact, these aren't my words. These are Madison's words. These are the framers' words as we went through the ratification debates. It's that simple. You either give them the ability or they usurp the ability to do the things that they want to do. And guess what? They've been usurping. So here's the thing. Your state constitutions have been changed. What were the mechanisms of changing your state constitution? Do you have this little clause that states in your state constitution that the United States Constitution is the supreme law of the land? Then you may want to go look and find out how you have an Environmental Protection Department without ever amending. Did they ever go and amend the Constitution formally as per the process in your state to grant the state the ability to create an Environmental Protection Agency or a state-level agency to interface with the national agency? I'll bet you they didn't. What ends up happening is when the federal government comes along and says, hey, we now have this power that we've taken upon ourselves, we've usurped, and now we require you to create an agency to interface with us. And so they use that little clause to do that when there's nothing constitutional about what the federal government just did. It's not within the Constitution. It is something the federal government is choosing to do outside of the Constitution. So, this is why auditing the federal government is first and foremost. You have to understand exactly what the federal government really has the power to do and what they don't have the power to do. Then you need to look at your state. And then you need to go through your state's powers and determine how those things were created. Because if it's a legitimate enumerated power, such as the Environmental Protection Agency, then you'll have to deal with that. But the fact of the matter is you'll have to change, if it exists, it will need to change so that no longer accounts to and is accountable for the federal government. Same thing with Health and Human Services, same thing with housing, same thing with all of these types of things. If you want your state to have these powers, that's okay. That's what constitutions are for. They're for amending to grant and delegate or take away powers. But if it was based upon the premise that the federal government is constitutional in anything they say, that is a false premise. It has to be something within the Constitution. This goes back to the civil rights and the ADA and a lot of these different acts that the federal government has been just passing and ramming down our throats without changing the Constitution. the states embrace it as the, you know, the supreme law of the land, when it's not. It's that simple. So what we're doing today is we're putting more pieces together. We're gonna have a conversation with Mr. Winters, Brent Allen Winters, the common law lawyer, and we're going to get into basically the similar conversation I just had with John Durash, because John Durash said, well, you know, talk to him. He can really, you know, break it down a little better, which is fine. I don't mind having to go through things. Sometimes you need to hear it from other people before it starts registering, start making sense, if you know what I mean. So in this particular case, we're going to be breaking down the common law grand jury. What are the nuts and bolts? Its background. How did common law become the law of the United States or the independent and sovereign states? Well, with that, you're going to find out, because when we come back from the break, we will have Mr. Winters, and after that, we will do a wrap up. Thank you so much, and please stay tuned. You're going to love this interview. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
That number to dial in is 215-TALK-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's, and if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
All right, we're here with Mr. Winters, the common law lawyer, and in a bunker of nondescript vicinity. So anyway, Mr. Winters, what I wanted to do, and I'm trying to get my arms wrapped around the common law grand jury, what I had referred to and mistakenly referred to as the citizens grand jury. But regardless, I believe that there is a role in being able to utilize it as a weapon currently in our constitutional crisis. Now, I'll get into that. But the questions that I have is, prior to the Declaration of Independence, my understanding is it was the law of the land because we were British citizens and common law was the law of the land.
In fact, on the 14th of October, 1775, I believe that was the year when Congress first met, the first time in Annapolis, Maryland, probably, they sent a letter off to their cousins over in England, and they said, we demand the rights of our common law, and most particularly the right to common law by jury. Or common law, just by trial by jury.
Right.
And they said, we demand the rights, and I'm quoting here, using their words, of our Constitution. Now, that was 11 years before the Constitution of the United States was a serious consideration in America.
Right.
But they demanded the rights of their Constitution. What was their Constitution? That was the common law of England. That's the way they understood it.
Right.
And our Constitution of the United States is a brief of that common law kind of government.
Correct. And so, again, prior, so I'm trying to lay this out for the audience, even for myself. So It was the law of the land in England. And so when we broke away from that, we didn't necessarily institute common law as the law of the land in the Articles of Confederation.
Oh, well, but it wasn't something that people even thought about having to do.
So absolutely. Yeah. So this will make sense to you. because it was the law of the land, and that's how they moved forward. Mm-hmm. And in the Articles of Confederation, my audience does understand the difference between a confederation and a federation, because a confederation delegates very little power to the general government and all other powers are retained. So it was a state issue if it wasn't in that Articles of Confederation. Here's the interesting thing. When we go from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution, most people think we became a federation. But we didn't. We maintained a confederacy because we only delegated very specific powers. And so this is the interesting thing that, and I've mentioned this maybe to you before, maybe not, but I mentioned this a bit when we were talking about common law was not delineated in the Constitution as the law of the land. In other words, the federal government's business was not, or the, I prefer to call it the general government. The general government's business was not to dictate to the states how they wanted to do business. And so one of the problems that George Mason had in the ratification debates is he came right out and said, hey, I have a problem with this because it does not establish common law as the law of the land. And, and I'm paraphrasing. So Mr. Nicholas's response to him I don't even know what the date. I'd have to look up the date. But Mr. Nicholas's response was this quote, "But, sir, the Constitution is defective because the common law is not declared to be in force. What would have been the consequence if it had? It would be immutable, but now it can be changed or modified by the legislative body may find necessary for the community." So in other words, and this kind of supports my whole essence that states were not to be determined to be slave states or free states. States had their own right of determination, whether whether they wanted to be a slave state. So in essence, the Missouri Compromise was a huge, egregious violation of the spirit of the Constitution and how it was defined, because it now forced slavery upon certain states and freedom upon others, where it took away the state's self-determination. So anyway, getting back to this common law thing and the history of common law. So I see every state basically kind of embraced this. And as we've talked before, civil law was embraced by Louisiana because of its ties to France and Rome. And so it was the aberration, or it has been, as far as I know, it's the only outlier out of the 50 states. All other states had declared or at some point had just embraced common law and did not declare civil law as the law of the land. So here's the question. Has there been a point in time where the states themselves officially had abandoned common law? Are you aware of any?
No. As a matter of fact, there's been an onslaught against our common law tradition. The great antagonist of our common law tradition is the only other tradition of religion, law, and government in the world, regardless of all the various labels, and that is the law of the city. The law of the city was on a rampage throughout the history of England to infiltrate. They did. The English Civil War was about that question. The American War for Separation from Britain was about that question, divine right of kings versus the common law. The king in England said he was emperor in the colonies. He didn't say he was king. He wasn't common law king. He was only common law king, he said, in England. But when you look at all of the writings of that time that came officially from the crown, it was always emperor of the colonies and of Canada, but king in England. Well, that's a big difference. An emperor is a one-man show, a government by one will, no three branches, no separation of powers. And so later on in America, the onslaught of the great antagonist of the common law continued.
Yes.
And there was a movement. There was a movement in America then after the War of 1812, so-called Madison's War, where the evil empire couldn't accomplish what they wanted nationally, just as the environmentalist hasn't been able to. And now, of course, what we have going on now with this virus, they can't accomplish it through the president, so they're trying to accomplish it state by state. The tyranny, the same thing happened with the forces that were promoting the law of the city, the civil law, the Code of Justinian, of the old Roman Empire in its various forms, including the canon law of the Church of Rome, that or the common law. And they had an organization of men, of great speakers that went around the country saying, we've got to get rid of the common law. Nobody even knows what the common law is. If I were to ask people, they're right about this. If I were to ask people, what is the common law? You just cited Mr. Mason. That was a fight about what the common law is. Is the common law declared the law of the land? And from the perspective of history, that's a silly question for this reason, because the phrase law of the land is our common law. That's what that phrase meant in Magna Carta, Lex Terra, Stephen Langton, the drafter of Magna Carta. That's what he meant when he said that. That was what our common law was called during that time back there in the 13th century, the year 1215.
Okay.
Before that, it was called the laws of Edward the Confessor. Then before that, it was called the laws of King Alfred. It was called the Volkreich. Okay. When the Germanic tribes, the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes, which are the Danes, were over on the continent of Europe, they called it the Volkreich.
Right.
So the names don't matter. What matters is, what was it?
Well,
and
so
back to simplicity. Go ahead, Gio.
Yeah, so there is a reason why, because we didn't create a new Kingdom of England or a branch off of England. We actually created a whole new government. And so at that point in time, there was a lack of really delineating all of this, because everything was just kind of carried forward.
I would agree. I would agree. Yeah, we didn't think about it. We just continued. We were fighting to carry it forward. And we had it. They were trying to take it away from us. We went to war with them to say, no, we're entitled to the same laws our cousins and of consanguinity over in England. We won the war. That
right.
means we have the right to keep and bear arms. That means we have the right to remain silent. That means we have a right against unreasonable searches and seizures without a warrant. And we also have the right, most significantly, only in common law countries, the right to trial by jury and grand jury indictments.
Right. So the reason I'm trying to create this foundation is because I do understand the Constitution, and the Constitution's intent was never to dictate the determination or the will or the direction that a state was to go. And so in looking at the deck, that's why I started with the Declaration, because that was truly the breaking away from England. And now we were 13 independent states, you know, and I don't want to say floundering, but we were struggling to try to create this government. We created the Confederacy, but it was inept and had all of these problems. So then they went back to the drawing board and they made minor changes. Now, when you really look at, and if you read the Federalist Papers, I think it's 40, 41, and 244, somewhere in there, it's where Madison is really defending himself, because the Anti-Federalists said, you guys violated the essence of the agreement of the convention because you went out and created a whole new government. And he actually goes and points out how they use the exact same verbiage and usage of words. They just rearrange things into different sections and so forth. But he was defending himself, saying, you know, I take exception. And I think if Madison was a bigger man, because he was obviously the shortest and smallest man we've ever had as president, and he was very feeble and weak, if you didn't know, you probably do know that. But anyway,
Can I throw something in?
Oh, sure.
About Madison. He was feeble and weak, and he was small. Yep. And when he got out of school, he almost killed himself. He did 4 years and 3 years at Princeton. And his favorite subject was Hebrew, and he wanted to go in the ministry. He didn't think he had the fortitude to do it. And he didn't. So he didn't. His mentor was Witherspoon, the president.
Yeah.
And all. And well, he, but in all of that, that little man of weakness, as far as I know, he's the only president that ever led troops into battle, and he did it because nobody else would, and the fellow that was supposed to turned tail and ran. And that was when the British troops came into Washington, D.C., and he ran out of the White House. You know the story, Dolly was trying to get the things of value out of the White House. The army was there, but the fellow that was leading them took off. The Navy showed up with artillery, and he, in civilian clothes, ran out in front of the army and led them against the British.
Right.
Fascinating story. But so don't judge the book by its cover.
No, absolutely.
You're not doing that, but I wanted to tell that story in case anybody thought otherwise.
I never put it into that context, and that's a great way of looking at it, because we've had lots of presidents that actually led battle, but never battle as a president. But here's another thing, because I've studied Madison a lot. He actually wrote in his journal after he graduated from Princeton, he prayed that he would that he could amount to something, because he knew his health and his disabilities were so overwhelming. He thought he was going to die several times. And he goes, I just pray that I can amount to something for this nation, because at that point in time, everybody's getting ready to go to war. And so, and look at what he ended up becoming, you know, the father of the Constitution. And he actually was the one that ended the Revolutionary War, because I if you look at the Revolutionary War, because Britain never abided by the agreements of the treaties, because they didn't feel that they had to. We couldn't force them. So because the treaty was never honored, the war really never ended. They just went back to regroup, and they finally figured out, well, this is how we're going to, you know, redo this war. And that's really what 1812 was.
You know, I get it. I get it. That was kind of my conclusion of the overall situation, too. But I interrupted your flow of thought, and don't let me drag you off too far.
So that's okay. So from the Declaration of Independence into the Articles of Confederation, they left everything to the states, and the states had basically already established their laws, and they even had their currencies and so forth. They realized in the Constitutional Convention some of those things had to change. Currency was going to change because the United States took these responsibilities on. So they made some minor changes, but when it came to law, they didn't make that change. And so the problem I think that most people have is that they don't really understand that that states do have the self-determination, and for the most part, every state clung to common law. And I believe it wasn't until the 20th century where states and the courts or the legal system within the state started perverting that and starting to try to get away from that, because they realized that common law is, in essence, the Constitution kind of mirrors this, because it has all of these checks and balances. And so, like the militia being the checks and balances, because if Congress writes a law that is so oppressive, who's supposed to enforce it? The militia. Well, that means that we have to put the guns to our own families and our neighbors, and we're not going to enforce a law that's oppressive. So that was the brilliance of all these checks and balances that were wrapped into this thing called the Constitution. So moving forward, now that we have the Constitution and the states have kind of gone down this path of embracing, not, and it's interesting that they didn't put a flag at the top of the mountain and say, we're declaring this, the, you know, common law land. They just kind of moved forward. So I believe that there have been a few states that have perverted or turned their backs on common law, and they've either done things, And only you can tell me whether this is true or not, but I believe that some states have actually perverted that so that common law, because they don't recognize common law grand juries.
Oh, courts say, or courts, state legislatures say silly things. I read recently that Utah said they've abrogated the common law in Utah. Well, if they've abrogated the common law in Utah, they've abrogated the Constitution of the United States having any force there. Well, that isn't going to happen. It didn't happen. It's legally impossible to happen. But they said that. And people say, well, that case Erie versus not Tompkins, 1937, U.S. Supreme Court, did away with the common law in the federal courts. Well, they did say that. The court even said that. But they should have been more careful how they said it, because they didn't do it. Listen, if the common law were done away with, there wouldn't be any juries. And there wouldn't be any grand juries, because grand juries and juries only exist in common law countries, and there's only about five of any great note in the world, and that'd be United States, England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, of course the Cook Islands, Tasmania. That's about it. Yeah. A few of the other colonies of Britain, like Belize, places like that, the Bermuda, to a very some degree India, because of the English influence there, they use juries, from what I understand. But to do away with the common law, it's easy to say we do away with it, but that's the elusiveness, the ever-elusiveness of our common law. How do you define it? Well, so how do you know where it is? Go ahead.
I can pitch in here. Yeah. For a state to actually just, you know, nonchalantly say we're just kind of doing away with this, or we're going to ignore this, then that means that they would have to ignore the Bill of Rights and the Seventh Amendment.
It's that simple.
Because the Bill of Rights, it says in suits at common law where the value, blah, blah, blah. And it ends with the rules of the common law. Yeah. And so the Bill of Rights actually did apply. And so this is the interesting thing. It applied to the fact that the federal government, or I should say the general government, was going to be an arbiter in the suits of common law, that they had these protections and we were protected from them of doing things of trials by judge and or other types, the suspension of habeas corpus and so forth. And I think we actually talked about that a little bit earlier. Yeah. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that when states actually have perverted this, unless they work together to amend the Constitution, I don't think they can necessarily abrogate or take away or, you know, surrender their the common law that they've embraced and change that system.
No, I agree.
Okay.
I agree. Even where I'm from, I live in an area, grew up in an area that used to be part of the colony of Virginia. It's not anymore, but it was at one time. And then during the war, it was recaptured from the British by order of Patrick Henry, who was the governor at the time. That was George Rogers Clark when he captured Vincennes, Indiana, and Cahokia. Well, that was all Virginia. And so that area there, which is the lower part of Illinois, Indiana, coming across in the lower third of Ohio and right on across about where the Mason-Dixon is, where West Virginia comes out, all that area south of the Ohio was Virginia. And so the state legislature says this, for example, in Illinois and Indiana, if there's anything that comes up in our courts, that has not been considered before and the legislature hasn't spoken to it, then the common law, the common law of England as it existed in the fourth year of James the First shall be applied. Well, the common law as it existed in the fourth year of James the First would have been 1607, which coincides with the first English settlement in Virginia, which was 1607. Mm-hmm. So they hark back and say, no, the common law applies. Well, but here's the elusive thing. Our common law is not a list of laws. It's not a list of do's and don'ts. It's a way of life, W-A-Y. It is a course to get on, a procedure. As a matter of fact, our common law doesn't include due process. Our common law is due process. And the Supreme Court has said so on several occasions, even to the point of saying the phrase of our Constitution, law of the land, means due process. And that's right. It means due process. That's what it means. And that's what it meant when it was first penned in Magna Carta in the Latin tongue, Lex Terra. They brought that forward. So the Constitution of the United States, if you'll notice, people stop to think about it, it doesn't tell us to do this and don't do that as much as it's saying and stressing, here's how the government is to operate, the general government in Washington, D.C. It's a how question, not a what question. It's a procedure. It's a course. That's why the Northwest Ordinance says, for instance, that we insist upon the jury and the trial according to the course of our common law, because our common law is a course. Back to you.
Right. Okay, so getting my arms around this. So every state except for Louisiana has and should be still on the embracing of common law. I'll just put it that way. So each state should be doing that. And understanding that they had passed this act, the Enabling Act, to allow the courts to take action. They, in essence, what Congress did with the Enabling Act, they violated the Constitution because they didn't amend the Constitution to grant the courts to actually create law. There has never been the role, responsibility, or power given to the court in the Constitution. It's only been done in spite of the Constitution because we've been protected from that the courts cannot create law. Their real role and function is this within the boundaries of the Constitution or the contract and or under cases of treaty and chancellery, admiralty, and these other types of cases. So anyway, back to the states, and the states having this embracing of common law. I believe, and I think you've actually covered this, that a common law grand jury consists of 25 people, and it does not require a unanimous decision. It only requires a majority decision.
Of a grand jury?
Of a grand jury, correct.
No, grand jury. No, that's a misnomer. Let me tell you what. Let me tell you what.
Well, that's why I'm calling. That's why we're talking.
Yeah, I know. That's very contrary. You hit me with that, and I said, now, wait a minute. Because I would listen to you talk, and I said, whoa, hold up your horses here. Let me think.
Right.
No, here's the way it is. Our common law is not a majority institution. It doesn't operate on a majority,
okay.
Not in the final analysis. And what it operates on is the jury. The jury is the final arbiter of right and wrong in individual instances from whose decision there is no appeal. If a jury reaches a verdict according to the course of the common law, there's no appeal from the facts it finds. And once it finds the facts, the verdict is foregone, the application of the law. The grand jury, of course, that's a unanimous decision, the pettit jury of the trial. The grand jury also operates on the same principle of 12 in agreement. If the grand jury is 12 people, all 12 have to agree. If the grand jury is 15, 12 have to agree. If the grand jury is 21, 12 have to agree. If the grand jury is 36, 12 have to agree to indict.
Ah.
So it's always the number 12.
Okay.
Now, if that, because lawyers and judges don't know that often, sometimes that's not followed. That's true. But that's not our common law, and
okay.
That's not the principle of the grand jury because,
okay.
Again, the grand jury and the pettit jury are not majority rule institutions. The majority principle does not apply fundamentally to our common law, which means this: democracy is not our common law. Even republicanism is not our common law, and we are not, in America, a republic. We are not a republic. To say that is contrary, and people say it, in our Constitution says that the general government will guarantee to the states a republican form of government. What does that mean? That means that the government will have a legislative branch. That's all it means. That's all it's ever meant. And once that legislative branch is seated and the states send also legislators to Congress, that ends the inquiry. The federal government has no power or authority, according to our Constitution, to intrude beyond that. But all that is saying is when you say the government has to have a legislative branch, and it does, our Constitution wouldn't work if the states didn't have a legislative branch because they couldn't send a senator to Washington, D.C., because that was the original plan of the Constitution, that the legislature would choose the state or the senator to send to Washington, D.C.,
right.
Not by popular vote as we do today. So that the general government had to say in the Constitution, we guarantee a republican form of government.
Right.
That doesn't mean it's a republic. China is a republic. The USSR, both of them communist states, were republics. Revolutionary France was a republic. We don't want that. What does that mean? A republic, that's happened, by the way, after the Revolution. I believe it was Pennsylvania said, oh, now we're free to do what we want. We're free of the king. We're going to have the state legislature. The will of the state legislature be final in Pennsylvania. I think it was Pennsylvania, but it was tried in more than one state. Well, they found out real quick that was worse than having one man in charge. To have a legislature, a combined will of many men into one in the form of legislation, a statute, to rule, it would become tyranny. So we are not a republican. And this story about Ben Franklin, that's apocryphal, as far as I can tell. I don't think there's any evidence that Ben Franklin ever said to that lady when he came out of the Constitutional Convention, a republican, ma'am, if you can keep it. Well, if somebody finds evidence of that, let me know. I've never seen any. But what I'm driving at is we are not a democracy. We are not a republic fundamentally. And democracy and republic, according to the people that invented the idea or accredited with the invention of it, the Greeks, they made no distinction between those two words, republic and democracy.
Well,
those were synonyms of the tightest sort. Back to you.
So actually, I could have helped save you some time because my audience is fully aware, because the way I put it,
okay.
Our government is a hybrid constitutional republic, a hybrid, because we have a constitution that lays out a form of general government giving defined powers and retaining a confederacy. That's why we're not a federation. We're a confederacy with a general government and republican form of government, because a republican form of government only means representation. But Here's the twist. When Roger Sherman in the Constitutional Convention came forward with the Connecticut Compromise, duly noted as the Sherman Compromise, he actually blew everybody away when he said, look, we're basically, and I'm paraphrasing, but America is a land of sovereigns. The people are sovereigns, and then they delegate to their government very specific powers, which makes them sovereigns over those things delegated. So this is where he brought in the balance or the check within legislative bodies, so that, or within Congress as the two legislative bodies, by giving the representation to the people and representation to the states. In other words, representation to sovereigns instead of just a representation of the people. And so,
well, I'm glad you pointed that out for this reason. Because we search, because our common law, again, the terms are elusive. It's messy. Ask any civil law lawyer throughout the world. We call them civilians. They'll say, you guys got a mess up there. You have no precision. It's ugly. And so we search for words or overlaps of meanings. And you've said, okay, I've got to define this. And I like the way you did it, really. What you said was it's a hybrid, a republican form. And that's what I've tried to stress, too. It is not a republic.
Right.
It's a republican form because that means we have a co-equal independent branch that's the representative legislature. And that's the way I'm thinking you're saying it.
Right. Yes. And so you're more correct by just calling our government, our national government, a confederacy. You're far more correct in just saying that, because a confederacy means that there is a general government with delegated powers, and most of the powers have been left to the states.
Yeah, that's true. And the reason I don't like the word confederacy, because it has Latin roots and I'm trying to get away from them.
Well, that's what Thomas Jefferson referred to when he was president. He referred to the United States as a confederacy. It was a pretty common usage.
And so, it was. I just say I still revolt against Latin words, but I'm not going to kick that.
Well,
go ahead.
It almost sounds like you're becoming a little politically correct. And
oh, yeah. Anyway,
okay,
if Jefferson said it, I know what he means.
Okay.
Yeah, I get it.
Let me move forward with this. Okay, so now we understand that a grand jury does not require a unanimous decision. It just requires a decision of 12. And the typical, so I'm just trying to get the bolts together here, the bolts and nuts, the parts and pieces of a grand jury at the county level would be 25, 20, or just...
Or you could make as many as you wanted. Traditionally, it's been... 24, 25.
Okay, but it has 19. To be a minimum of 12, sounds like.
Oh, no question, no question.
That's okay. Right. Okay, so understanding the pieces, the cognizance, or those who have authority to call upon a grand jury would be, and as I understand it, from Francine, she pointed out the coroner has the ability, but we all know and agree that the sheriff of the county does have the authority and power to call forth a grand jury to investigate and or I'll just use the word investigate and come up with a ruling, indictment or what have you.
Oh, you investigate anything. I lived in a county once where the grand jury was called to investigate the prisons in the county.
Before we move forward, I just want to make sure, because I didn't get your acknowledgement. Yes, a sheriff does actually possess the authority.
Certainly, if a sheriff, yes.
Okay. All right. So with that, this is where I'm going. And as a matter of fact, I'm looking at my time, and we're coming close, but we do have some time to, you know, I think, squeeze this in. This is where I want to go. And if we need to go longer, we can do another segment. I believe, and we have sheriffs in some of these red states that are so fed up, they support the Constitution. They can't believe that these things are real. It's just that I'm going to use the word ignorant. They're not imbecile ignorant, and they're not obtuse ignorant. They are educated, inculcated ignorant. Because
organized ignorance you're talking about.
There you go.
I'm with you. No, okay. I see it.
And so and it's almost like almost everybody is, you know, kind of smelling and tasting, but they just can't necessarily put their teeth into the meat. And so what we're trying to do is we want to actually get as many county sheriffs to form a common law grand jury. And this is what we want them to do. We want them to fully investigate and determine whether or not the state or the federal government has the ability to declare martial law in our constitutional standing currently. And I say this because, and I can give you all the evidence in the ratification debates, when it came to martial law, Madison clearly stated that martial law could not be declared just carte blanche. It could only be declared in a state where the militia has been deployed, whether that be by the governor or by Congress, because people think president, but actually it's Congress is supposed to call forth to execute. And then the chief executive becomes the commander in chief when he's been granted access to the militia. But anyway, it was very clear. Actually, Madison also said that it couldn't be declared in states where they didn't have it. It had to be where the militia had been deployed. So there could be a case such as Connecticut that deploys its militia down to New Mexico because they need extra help and they got some fresh bodies because of this invasion on the southern border. Martial law would not be declared in Connecticut where they've been deployed from, only in where they've been deployed to. Mm-hmm. So the point is that because we don't have a militia, the governor, the president, and these two different bodies, the state governments and this general government, does not have the constitutional authority right now in our constitutional situation or condition to call forth a martial law and or call forth a militia because it doesn't exist.
Well, even if you call forth a militia, I would say that that's not a reason enough to declare martial law. Yeah, I would
So you're right. You're right. There are stipulations as to how the militia can be called up. There has to be either a insurrection against the laws of the land and or an invasion and or rebellion. And so bottom line is I'll just call it this medical emergency, this coronavirus, does not warrant even the declaration. Even if the militia was in place, it wouldn't warrant it.
No. And the only way that, reading the calculus of history on the subject, the only way that justifies a martial law situation is if the common law courts are closed. It doesn't make any difference what else happens. The key is the court or the common law courts, which are the only courts we have in 49 of our states. And so if the courts are open, martial law is not enforced. I would ask people today, consider, are the courts open? Could you impanel a jury? And clearly the answer is no. I get emails from the courts where I've practiced, and they tell me the court is closed except for emergencies. Friends, neighbors, and kin, we're under de facto martial law, and they're taking us for idiots. And unfortunately, I've noticed that many of my fellow Americans have put their brains in a bucket and fired a 45 slug into it. That's what I'm seeing.
Yes.
And I'm discouraged about it, but talking to people like you encourages me. And I see what happened down in Texas. I'm encouraged. The writ of habeas corpus came to the forefront, and the Supreme Court of Texas acted on it. So there is some positive things happening here.
Okay.
But this thing about martial law is front and center. What is it? How do we know it's in place? And I say it's in place when the courts are closed. Go ahead.
So it is in place whenever there is a declaration or a suspension of your civil rights. And when I use the word civil rights, I'm talking about the rights that are actually protected by the law. I'm not talking about the new age civil rights. In other words, do you have a right of religious expression? Yes. Do you have a right of peaceable assembly? Yes. Those are civil rights that are protected by the Bill of Rights. And they're also applied by the 14th Amendment. So in other words, states can't violate your constitutional privileges and immunities, as it says in Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. And the federal government can't do this. So in other words, the only way they can actually suspend your constitutional rights is they have to declare martial law. And the only way they can do that is for the purposes that we mentioned. And they, for martial law to actually be declared, they have to deploy them. In other words, they have to ask the citizens to come and enforce either this, you know, to stop this rebellion or stop this insurrection or to stop this invasion, because the militia is the citizenry or the citizen army. It is not the National Guard. It is not the U.S. military. As a matter of fact, when they talked back and forth between militia and army, they were synonymous. The only standing military force that was separate from the militia was the Navy and the Marine Corps. And as a Marine, it kind of makes me happy to say that.
No, that's right. There is a separation there. I agree with you. But the courts are key. I keep pounding away at the courts are key. The only way they can get martial law in America without shutting down the courts is if the American people are stupid enough to wave and go along with them, like many of them are doing.
I do agree with you, because it's not like the courts have been closed. But another form of, so there's many definitions of martial law. And I understand that there's this technical line, but when they start suspending your individual privileges and immunities that are protected by law, then they're tantamount to calling martial law. They're just not saying that we're declaring it, because they know they're stepping on big toes when they say that they're declaring martial law. So what they're doing with one hand is saying, well, we're just going to protect you. But with the other hand, they've actually are waging tyranny.
You know, martial law is that kind of a law that is the law of the city. The law of the city is fundamentally martial law and all the forms of it, whether it be the Uniform Code of Military Justice, of course, covers all our armed forces. But throughout the world, armies on fields of battle, ships, and the men on those ships at sea, those are under a martial kind of a law where there is no jury. When you're on a ship at sea and you go to captain's mast, there's no jury. All you got's the old man. He makes the decision by himself. He is the next thing to God. The next thing. Not God, but the next thing to God in that circumstance. And in, when it comes to ships at sea and armies on fields of battle, and that would include the Marine Corps, not to leave you out, crying out loud. But when it comes to that, that's right. That's the proper use of martial law. It has to be that way in those environments, because if orders aren't followed, of course, that are lawful. We temper that. Well, but if orders aren't followed immediately, countries are lost. So the penalties are death.
So I have good news. I have some good news and bad news.
Go ahead.
And I have to inject, because the bad news is we've run out of time, but the good news is we can extend this into the next segment. So, folks, don't go away. We're going to be right back after these promos, and we'll have Mr. Winters in our next episode. So please stay tuned. Thank you so much. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
Now, I'm not sure about you, but I think this is kind of easy stuff to follow. Now, if you have questions, if you have a problem, as a matter of fact, I've offered this before. We have a comment line. If you just want to make a comment, you've got a question, you can just dial 425-270-5416. If you actually want to discuss or talk, you can send me an email, info@reclaimingtherepublic.org. If you would like to even take that further, if your questions are really those types of questions that really require more of a dynamic conversation, I will be happy to. And we can go back to and revisit, because we've done this before. And it's been a while, but we've done this before. We've actually had a listener call, or we have a like an interview, or we kind of go through the questions so that we can help you understand what it was we just said. Because sometimes we hear things differently than other people. We're, even though we're all unique, and I just said this to a listener, so we're going to have a listener on, but you can easily... And I do this because we don't do live shows, just due to the fact that the timing and everything else is just, for the past over a year, my life has been interrupted by, you know, tragedies and so forth. And so I've had to kind of work around my schedule and all the demands upon my schedule. So anyway, long story short, it's not that we're trying to cut you out, but what we do want to do, if you do want to engage with questions or what have you, just let us know, because we want you to get this. We want you to understand this. Why? Because you need to be the person that actually goes down to your, you know, your county meetings, to through your neighborhood, and start educating and start helping other people to understand this stuff. It's not that hard. I think the metaphor of, or the comparison of, the power of attorney to the Constitution really helps people make that click. Oh, wow, that makes sense now. Now I understand an enumerated Constitution in context to an enumerated power of attorney. My friends, this isn't rocket science, and it doesn't take that long to really start putting things together and start understanding. And when you really start reading and understanding the heart of the principles, the two primary principles, both stemming around liberty, individual liberty and individual sovereignty, then you start understanding why the Constitution was designed the way it was, why there were so many checks and balances that we didn't even recognize this. I mean, how long has it really gone to where people started understanding that the whole reason why the militia was integrated into our Constitution was to keep the federal government from being able to enforce their own laws, their own tyranny, because they knew that was the foundation of tyranny, giving them that type of power. Well, we're going to be back with Mr. Winters, and we're going to actually talk about how we can use the grand juries to be a catalyst for Republic Review. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of of the solution.